Mammoth
Audio. This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. The one thing I was always taught when I was learning magic was to never make your tricks into puzzles. After all, if the audience is distracted trying to peek behind the curtain and figure out how you did it, they're going to miss the show. Magician David Kwong has gone the opposite direction, not only embracing puzzles in his magic, but also working as a professional crossword creator for the New York Times. His TED Talk on magic and puzzles has over 1.5 million views on YouTube, and he even helped create the effects in the Magician heist movie, Now You See Me. So here it is, one down, eight letters, an angry conversation about puzzles. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. David, you are a magician and a creator of crossword puzzles, but are they the two main things that you're known for?
Those are the two main categories, yes. I would say magician and puzzler in general. I like all sorts of puzzles, but the most marquee puzzles that I make are crosswords for the New York Times.
I've come up with a title for this episode of the podcast, which is itself a puzzle. It's actually a cryptic crossword clue, which you may be able to solve, but I understand you're not a cryptic crossword guy.
I don't do them with regularity. The New York Times will have one every few months as a bonus puzzle, and I will struggle through it, and it'll take me a week to finish the whole thing. So I am by no means an expert at the cryptics, but I do think it's England's greatest contribution to the puzzle world, if not the entire world. So go for it. Give it to me.
Okay, here we go. I'm going to call this episode an angry conversation about puzzles, but it is also a crossword clue. So can you figure out the answer to an angry conversation about puzzles?
Okay, let me write it down. An angry conversation.
Yep.
About
puzzles.
Puzzles. Well, in my rudimentary understanding of cryptic formula, I would say you want to angry usually means to mix up.
I do not. I really appreciate that you've given me a lot more credit than I am due.
About usually means going around.
Yeah.
So, well, I would think the full definition is puzzles. You're really making me work here.
I am straight out of the gate. Should we leave it? Should we leave it as like a tangling
sort
of
piece? Well, let me ask you this, because yeah. I usually am afforded the amount of letters.
All right. Let's see. 9 letters.
All right. I have a guess.
Okay.
No, I don't, because it's 10. Okay. I don't know. We'll come back to it.
Okay. Can we come back to it? Can we leave it?
Over the course of the next hour, I will stare at this piece of paper and try to figure it out.
All right, excellent. And then I'll either put you out of your misery or you'll come triumphant with the answer. Because there are rules of crosswords, aren't there? I mean, crosswords have certain patterns that you are expected to follow in order to be not necessarily a true crossword, but one that will please a puzzler.
That's right. Yeah, those rules exist both for the solver and for the constructor. It's probably best to start with the rules that a cruciverbalist, which is a fancy word for the constructor, might follow, which are an American crossword. They are always rotationally symmetric. That means the black squares are always in the same place if you were to rotate the paper upside down 180 degrees. There are no two-letter words. Those are too easy. So three is the minimum. There always has to be an across and a down. You always have to check the letters, because if there's something very difficult, it should be crossed with some easy things. That's usually what we keep in mind as we're making a puzzle.
So just purely, so if someone gets stumped by one of the clues that is, for example, horizontal, they know they're going to be able to get a few of the vertical ones and give themselves more information right to be able to solve the puzzle.
And as you're making them, you can't just put the black squares anywhere. You have to keep the symmetry. And that's a challenge for the constructor. If you could put the black squares anywhere, you could break up difficult letter combinations. You know, you could just stick it right in front of the Q to ensure that your word starts with a Q instead of ends with a Q. It just makes it a little more challenging. And there's a word count, by the way, as well. You can only have, I think, in the daily New York Times crossword, 78 words is the maximum. I hope that you find this interesting, because it could terribly bore some people.
No, we have a very dull listenership of Scammapalooza, so don't worry about that.
Anyway, next time you look at the crossword puzzle, flip it upside down 180 degrees, you'll see those black squares are in the same place.
And it follows all the way around. You mentioned the themes, and it seems the themes, I think, are, to me, what makes a really great crossword puzzle, because it is like a great con artist movie or film with a twist, which we will get to. That's another area of expertise of yours. But that everything, all of the pieces come together, and there's a sudden sort of revelation. One of the most famous themed puzzles was the Clinton Bob Dole wins, I think it was, election. Yes. Puzzle.
Yes, that is arguably the most famous puzzle. I know it's Will Schwartz's favorite puzzle. He's the editor. Yes, it could either have been Clinton wins or Bob Dole wins. They're both seven letters long. It was, the clue for it was headline in tomorrow's newspaper. So they were calling the election. And it was ingenious. You could put both sets of letters in there. I could tell you, I think, what they all are because I've looked at it so many times. For example, the B that starts Bob Dole or the C that starts Clinton.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Was clued as black Halloween animal.
That's right. And it could be either cat or bat.
Cat or bat, right.
Yeah.
The next one, the O in Bob or the L in Clinton was French 101 word, so it was either we, O-U-I, or Louis, L-U-I. I won't do all of them, but probably the next one is the best, which is, let's see if I can reconstruct this. Yes, it was provides support, something like that. It was maybe provide support for short, and it was either IRA, like a Roth IRA, which is an investment account, or it was BRA, B-R-A. So that was probably the best of the bunch.
And that's something where people appreciate what you've done as a puzzle creator, in that they have sort of seen just a little bit behind the mask, and they've seen the amount of effort and work that's gone into the puzzle, and then there's that sort of appreciation of the form almost as a work of art. Do you think it is a work of art? I mean, like, without getting too pretentious, but do you think that making a crossword puzzle, do you think it is a craft, or do you think it is, you know, that has to follow sort of certain logical and almost, you know, mathematical rules and formulas in order to make it work? Or do you think it is something where you're making a thing of beauty?
I do think it's a work of art. I don't think it's fine art, but I would say, if anything, it's storytelling. A good puzzle is one that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. It has that aha moment. That's the term we use for when you unlock the puzzle. You figure out what's going on. You figure out what the twist is. And there's usually some sort of exclamation point at the end. But like magic tricks, like confidence games, they are the best puzzles are usually misleading, and there's red herrings and misdirection. The difference is, of course, that a good puzzle seeks to have the solver figure it out. Of course, with a magic trick, you don't want that to happen. With a confidence game, you don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
Will Schwartz, I'll reference him many times over the course of this
talk. And for those who don't know, he is the editor of the New York Times crossword, and also, I mean, he's somewhat of a legend in terms of the sort of puzzle community. People are to his name in hushed tones, and that's largely due to the documentary about him. Is that's really
Wordplay. Wordplay is a great documentary, 2007. It tracks the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament. And, of course, you have these quirky, odd characters. But it is surprisingly dramatic. Something happens over the course of that tournament that you would never expect. So I highly recommend it. Now, Will Schwartz is a legend because he is this figurehead in the puzzling gaming space. But I also think it's because he's so generous and benevolent and fun and kind-hearted. And his attitude towards puzzles, I've really adopted, and this is what it is. He says that a good puzzle is one that makes the solver feel smart as they're doing it. So you never want to make something that's too confounding or unsolvable.
Yeah.
And when you get to that aha moment, there is this simultaneous respect for yourself because you're smart and you figured it out. And respect for the constructor who came up with the clever trick, the clever ruse, the story, frankly. So that is what I strive for when I make my puzzles, and I get that from Will. So check out that documentary. It's a lovely feature on the tournament and a really nice tribute to him.
There is, you mentioned the aha moment, and that's something that my editor is always sort of pointing out, because I write crime novels about con artists, and she's always pointing out that there's a big difference between an aha moment in a movie or in any sort of story and a gotcha moment. And a gotcha moment is one where the creator, in your case, the puzzle maker, in my case, the author, has pulled the wool over the readers, the consumer's eyes in a way in which they can't possibly have ever figured it out. And it's a sort of kind of a nasty moment. Is that something that you have to be wary of as a crossword creator, that you're worrying more about making yourself look smart and less about making the person doing the crossword feel smart?
Well, crosswords are, they're fairly self-contained. Everyone knows what the end goal is. So it's hard to do the gotcha. That's something that would probably apply to more of storytelling and writing novels, because there aren't really parameters.
Because the crossword creators, here in Australia, there's one who is, just goes by DA, David Astle, I think is his name, and he writes cryptic crosswords, and he is constantly getting hate mail in the paper from people who are upset with his clues, because they've seen them as too hard or impossible to get, and then other people writing to defend him. Do you think that those people who feel like it's too hard or they could never have got it have a point?
Okay, again, we're just talking about crosswords here. If there's something that's confounding, it might be just a particular word that's too modern for people or too esoteric, and yes, the blogs will sound off. But with Will Schwartz as the editor, it's rare that a theme for the puzzle is going to be so obscure or so confounding that it would see print. You know, it's the New York Times prides itself as the gold standard, and people, the things that make the newspaper really are, they feed into people's expectations. Now they push the envelope, but it's always solvable. If you indulge me, I'll tell you some of the puzzles that I've written for the New York Times.
Yeah. Well, some of the ones you're proud of.
I'm most proud of the ways that I've pushed the envelope in the Times puzzle. So that's really the question, right? It's, you have a 15 by 15, or 21 by 21 if it's a Sunday, the size of the grid. You have rotational symmetry. You have all these rules. How do you come up with something new when the puzzle's been around for 100 years? It's been around for 101 years at this point. Everything's been done. What can you come up with? So I've managed to make a few that I'm proud of. The first was, I co-wrote it with my friend Kevin. It was themed on think outside the box. So if you take the box literally to be the crossword puzzle grid, the letters T-H-I-N-K were spilling outside the grid. You had to write those letters in the margin. So it would be a five-letter word, but there'd be only four spaces. So you would have to put the T in the margin.
Oh, that's clever.
Yeah.
Did that annoy anyone? Does anyone feel like you had broken, you'd gone too far in that sort of puzzle?
No, because it's all self-contained and cogent. Once you get to the end, it makes sense. It was, one of the long ones was overfloweth. So the H in overfloweth was outside the box. It was part of the letters T-H-I-N-K. And overfloweth clues the solver into what's going on. And what else did we have? No place to go was another long one. And the N from no place to go was in the border as part of the word think. And also, they published that one on April Fool's Day, which is the day, that's the trophy, when you're supposed to have a really tricky one. The other day that's really tricky, I'm proud to say I've also published on, and that's Halloween. And I had a very fun one a couple of years ago. And running down the middle of the grid was the word mirrors. Trick for this was, on the left side, you would have a Universal Studios monster creature, like Wolfman, and then it would hit the mirror, and on the right side, you would have the word Wolfman spelled backward. So N-A-M-F-L-O. And then Phantom was another one on the left side. And then on the right side, you would have Phantom spelled backwards. M-O-T-N-A-H-P. There were a number of these. And in the lower left-hand corner, as the final Universal Studios Monster Creature, you had Vampire. And on the right side, there was nothing where the reflection was supposed to be. So there were these empty spaces in the crossword that hopefully fooled people for quite a while.
Oh, I would have found that frustrating, because once I figured it out, when I've completed a crossword, I want to be looking at nothing but a bit of letters. I don't want to see blank spaces, even if they're supposed to be there.
It was fun because you would be looking at it and you would think that the cross ones, the ones going vertically, were five letters long, but they were really just four. Another puzzle, and I'm perhaps most proud of this one, was a Mad Magazine tribute. And I constructed this again with my friend Kevin Chosett. We did a Mad Magazine fold-in puzzle. Yeah, you would fold the right side over to the left, and it would create new words. And that one took us like 2.5 years to make. These new words that you created were things like newspaper and poker hand and laundry, and these were all things that you could fold. So it was we're really proud of that one.
Yeah, layers on layers. I guess that brings us though to magic, which is obviously your other passion. And I was always taught as a magician that you shouldn't make magic that is a puzzle. So your goal as a magician is to hide things from your audience in a way in which they cannot figure them out. Whereas your job when you're making crosswords is to hide things from your I don't know what you call them. What do you call people who do crosswords?
Solvers.
Solvers. To hide things from your solvers until they figure them out. Whereas as a magician, you obviously, as you mentioned before, you don't want them to figure it out. But you've right. sort of pride yourself on your ability to combine the two of them, most famously in your crossword routine, in which I won't give too much away, but you create a crossword live on stage, and it has some magical secrets hidden in it that are completely impossible, and yet you manage to do it. We'll put a link up so people can watch what you actually perform it rather than hear me describe it. Do you think that, I mean, can you make magic into a puzzle? Is that a good idea?
Well, I agree with you. It's a puzzle, but it's one where you're holding back the solution. So I am sort of contradicting myself a little bit. But then again, this is somebody going to a magic show and not sitting down to do the Sunday morning New York Times crossword. Well, my approach to magic, first of all, is that I don't pretend to have any superpowers. And most magicians, 99% of them, pretend in some way or another that they have supernatural abilities. From mentalists to, I mean, all the greats, all the big ones, David Blaine, Chris Angel, I would argue even your birthday party magician, at times, is pretending to read minds. But there are a few of us in the 1% that acknowledge right from the beginning that it's all tricks and that it's all sleight of hand and it's all misdirection. Penn and Teller probably lead the crusade with that. I would say certainly the Amazing Randy doesn't pretend to have any superpowers. In fact, he's a big debunker. And I do the same thing. So I basically say at the beginning of my show, ladies and gentlemen, this is all a puzzle. You can try to figure it out. I don't have any superpowers. I am going to demonstrate how I am one step ahead of you. So I suppose that I use the word puzzle to be synonymous with this is a scientific exercise. You know, this is an exercise in perception and reasoning, and it's my job to obfuscate the solution for as long as possible.
Something you notice when you watch your TED talk that you did, in which you do, again, a fantastic, you know, magic routine, but then you lay down the challenge to the audience to see if they can solve it. And in the comments, the YouTube comments for that, most people there's a lot of people just saying, oh, I just want to enjoy it. And then there are a lot of people trying to figure it out, but never in that nasty way in which people try and figure out magic tricks. Never that sort of, oh, he was just using magnets, or he was just doing this, or he was, you know, oh, that's all it is. It's just this, it's just a trick. But because you were so open about it and so welcoming of their theories, people were quite polite and quite interested.
Okay. Well, there's a lot going on here. First of all, people will come up to me after the show, or they'll email me and they'll say, I figured this out. I know what you did. And I'll say, great, it's a puzzle and you have the solution, but please don't share the solution with anybody else. So that's kind of my line. Let other people enjoy the enigma. But in doing so, I'm saying, yes, I don't have superpowers. Good job. You're smart. You figured it out. The TED Talk, I try not to read the comments, but occasionally I'll see one that someone will say, first of all, there are some nasty ones. Well, not actually. No one's nasty. No one's nasty. My favorite comments are the ones where people say, because of the very fact that we are all discussing this right now in the comments, proves David Kwong's point that we are all wired to solve. So David Kwong wins in the end. And I just love that because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to incite discussion. I wanted to incite solving.
Most magicians say, look at this miracle. You can't figure it out. That's the subtext. Whereas for you, the subtext is, look at this supposed miracle. There is a solution. Perhaps you'd like to figure it out.
I think when you are pretending to have superpowers, it invites people to try to break that illusion and that wall down. And I say, the very first thing I say in that TED Talk is, I'm a magician and a puzzler, and this is all a puzzle. See if you can figure it out. Now, that said, Nick, I have received plenty of angry emails from people because even though I say that, what TED stands for is sacred to people. So some people have gotten really angry that I subverted the TED Talk genre by sort of messing with the format.
Well, that's an interesting point. I was talking to James Munton, who is a magician out of Dallas who performs sort of shows about cyber safety and internet security. And we're talking about this fairly new idea of magicians as experts. So rather than magicians being entertainers, magicians are now seen as having knowledge and information that is of use to the rest of the world. And so people like yourself, David Blaine, Darren Brown, have been asked to give these types of talks where they are explaining and exposing secrets. And James's point was that perhaps magicians shouldn't be experts and perhaps they shouldn't be giving these talks because we do deal in illusion. You know, we deal in tricks and we can sometimes lead people down the garden path. I don't necessarily think that's something that you've done with your TED Talk, in that it's quite clearly, you know, it's about puzzles and you presented a puzzle. But do you think there is that danger of magicians being presented as experts?
Oh, I see what you're saying. It's like when I've been approached, and often it's because of the TED Talk, an advertising company would say, can we hire you to help us influence people in our marketing. And subliminal messages do exist, but not on the level that they're hoping for. You know, this I'm sure Darren Brown gets requests for neuro-linguistic programming work and how to influence people, and I'm sure he has to turn it down as well, because for the most part it's theater, you know. So if I take your question correctly, it's when a magician is hired for the skill that he pretends to have. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it feels like sometimes that Darren Brown's a great example, that there's a massive spike in interest in neuro-linguistic programming since he came on the scene from people who don't quite understand that what he's doing is magic tricks. And it reminds me of the spiritualism movement, people coming up on stage and pretending to have psychic powers and then performing mentalism and magic, and then perhaps giving a bit of credence to the idea of talking to the dead in the real world.
When we're under scrutiny by the scientific method, we can fool the scientists as well and just propel the illusion further.
Like Banachek did with the Project Alpha in the 70s.
Exactly. Where have you seen that documentary, An Honest Liar? It's great.
I haven't actually seen it. It's on my Netflix list of things to watch. Fantastic. But the story is amazing. And it's that they basically fooled scientists into believing they had psychic powers because the scientists were sort of predisposed to believe in it and were fooled.
There's a phrase that bookends that documentary, which is something, I'm going to paraphrase, the most intelligent people can still be fooled. And that's exactly what's happening. Those scientists were conducting what they thought were controlled experiments, and these magicians at very clever moments would figure out ways to tamper with the control, to create offbeats where they say, hey, can we take a break for a second? I'm going to get a cup of coffee. And then in that moment, they would peek at the cards or rig up some invisible thread on something. And then they say, okay, we're back. Let's resume the test. You know, we know how to operate in the shadows. And we can fool the most intelligent people.
I guess that brings us to your movie work, because you're a consultant on a lot of films to do with magic and deception, and that's through the Misdirectors Guild, which you've sort of founded as a way of consulting on these types of projects. Perhaps most famously, Now You See Me and Burt Wonderstone. And on Now You See Me, you were the head magic consultant. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I this all came out of my work in Hollywood as a development, story development guy. So I was working with writers and producers and directors, and I was at DreamWorks Animation, Now You See Me came across my desk, and I read it, and I tracked it for years. And finally, when it got close to production, I started working on the script and working with the producers, and then I quit DreamWorks to go every day on set for that movie. I did way more for that movie than I did for Burt Wonderstone. I can't really take too much credit for that. I worked a little bit on the script of Burt Wonderstone, and then David Copperfield and his team were very involved in that. A magician named Jonathan Levitt did work on Burt Wonderstone. But Now You See Me was years of my life.
I think perhaps the most striking moment is the opening of the film, which is an incredible card trick is performed sort of on the audience themselves. Were you sort of involved with that aspect?
I was, yeah. The director, Lou Leterrier, wanted to do a trick on the audience. That kind of... Geez, do I want to spoil it? I don't know. That kind of card selection method is a good one for camera. David Blaine most famously did it on one of his specials. But I would say what I'm most proud of is the story work. I spent many, many hours with Ed Solomon, who was one of the screenwriters. And I worked with Keith Barry, the mentalist out of Ireland. And we would kind of hole up in Los Angeles, and we would figure out the story. And they had some cool heists to start that were Mission Impossible-esque, but I was able to really kind of shape them in the way that magicians might rob a bank. I kind of had two goals for it. I wanted the big final trick of the movie to be rooted in the simplest of all kids' birthday party tricks. So that's how I came up with the rabbit box and the mirror. I'm not going to say too much more if you haven't seen the movie. Look, I knew that I wanted to use the principle in magic where you often claim something's finished before it actually is. So you might say, I'm going to get a card in the box. You've signed a card, I'm going to get it in this box here. And then you pretend that it's done, and you convince the audience it's done, and they all applaud. And it's in that moment, in that offbeat, when you actually slip the card in the box. So I kind of wanted that principle to be in there.
Yeah, I did notice it sort of hit a lot of beats of magic. The sort of the structure of the routines and the structure of the acts felt very magical in nature. As you said, it sort of felt as if I was watching a magic trick unfolding. Do you feel as if a lay audience, so someone who's not familiar with magic, would appreciate that level? Or do you think they just kind of get the same buzz that they get from a magic trick from watching the movie?
No, I think they do appreciate it because we revealed some of these things. And I definitely was criticized by many other magicians for doing so, but that's my approach to magic. Once again, I don't pretend to have superpowers, and I think of it all as a puzzle, and by that I mean like an intellectual exercise. And I was fine with pulling back the curtain and revealing some of these principles in order to get the audience to appreciate magic more and all the work and thought and planning that goes into a magic trick. So Now You See Me is structured that way. My own stage show is structured that way. And when I write about magic, I do the same thing. And but, you know, there are many magicians that have this sort of this absolute code that they follow. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about a trade secret or whether it's a little kid's birthday party coloring book or a sucker die box or some, you know, some trinket, you do not give anything away. So we pissed off plenty of people, but I think we got more people globally to appreciate magic, for sure.
One of the things that I struggled with the film is when they brought in CGI, the bubbles, the silks that are flying around the stage that are clearly to anyone watching CGI, and they leapt out at me as not magical because they were CGI. Do you think that, like, when magic is presented on film, that it's okay to do that? Or do you think there is sort of a... In order to make it feel real, it's got to sort of be practical. It sort of reminds me of the difference between CGI and practical special effects.
Yes, it's a fair criticism. Here's the thing. We had plenty of sleight of hand in it to keep the practical there. But the bigger stuff, for the most part, we use CGI on those exact routines that you mentioned. The reason was, it was that Louis Leterrier, the director, he wanted these magicians to be superheroes, right? And they were superheroes. He always said to me that they were the magicians of tomorrow. They were slightly near future superheroes. So the exercise that he always put me through was, can you think of a trick that you've always wanted to do, but you don't have the method for it yet? So you might be able to do it in like 10 years if somebody works it out. So it's nothing too impossible, but it's just outside of reach right now. And that's how we came up with Isla Fisher floating over the audience in a bubble. It started with, okay, what do magicians do? They levitate women on stage. Well, has anyone ever levitated a woman up to the balcony? No. Do you think that we might be able to do that in 10 years? Yeah, with the right kind of wire rigging, we'll probably get there. And then we enhanced it further with a bubble. Sure, maybe at some point somebody will come up with the right kind of solution that will withstand the wires, or I don't really know. But it seemed plausible to me that it's something that we would eventually be able to do. And the only way to pull that off was with CGI. If we did it practically, then we would have had come up with it already. And,
and then it wouldn't be magic of the future.
Yeah, we'd be rich people.
sold it to Chris Angel. Yeah.
So that's kind of how, that's where we got. And we tried to put other sleight of hand in the film, and flourishes and coin slights and then magic into the story, into the structure of it. So there probably could have been more practical visual tricks in the film, more winks to the audience, you know, having fun with their perception. But, you know, it is what it is. The movie did well. We were very pleased.
It did very well. There's a sequel coming out, isn't there? Don't you have the...
Yes.
That's
yeah.
Coming with...
They're calling it the second act. So I'm sure we'll see a third one as well.
Brilliant. And it will have, and it has Harry Potter in it. I refuse to say Daniel Radcliffe. It's a movie about magic. It has Harry Potter in it. That's very exciting. Well, thank you so much for coming on Scamapalooza.
I have to figure out your...
You still have to figure out. I normally finish with the Con Man's Dictionary, where I sort of I give a turn of phrase from the world of the con man and see if we can come up with the answer. But I think we should go with this as our puzzle. So it is Angry Conversation About Puzzles. It's also the name of this episode. So any ideas?
Well, I think angry is mixing things up. So I'd either reverse the N-A, or I would scramble up the letters of conversation, but that's going to be too long. I mean, I'm looking for a synonym for puzzles. I would have thought conundrums, but that's one letter too long. So you got me.
It's all synonyms. So a synonym for angry is cross. A synonym for a conversation is to have a word with someone. And a puzzle is a crossword. The answer was crossword, the very thing we were discussing.
Let's make sure the plural is right, though.
So it should have been a conversation about puzzles.
There's a way to do it. It might be... might just be angry conversations are puzzles, I think you could do.
All right.
Look, it's the structure's still there and you fooled me, so
that's the important thing. Excellent.
Yeah, you can gloat about it.
I'll invite you back, and it'll just be 45 minutes of me gloating. Wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Good if I could come up myself with a puzzle right now.
Yeah.
Let's see. Here's one of my favorite crossword clues. And the answer is four letters long. And the clue is picked locks. And it's a pun, so it'll end with a question mark. Picked locks. So if you can figure that out, it's four letters.
All right. So people figure it out, they should tweet you.
I'm at David Kwong. That's K-W-O-N-G.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. As always, you can find out more at conman.com.au. This has been Scammapalooza.